this generate our motivation? Again, with a very acute awareness of the transient nature of our life and the opportunity a precious human life affords us. To have a strong determination to use our time very well. Because at the time we die, no worldly objects come with us. Our friends don't come with our reputation, our possessions, our money. All the worldly acclaim, our whole ego identity, even our body, none of it comes with. The only thing that goes on with the mind stream is the imprints of the actions we've done, the mental habits we've created. So seeing that those are quite important and that we have the opportunity, if we take the opportunity, to create positive actions that leave good imprints on our mind, to familiarize ourselves with the Dharma and virtuous emotions and attitudes. Seeing that we can do that if we take the opportunity, if we choose, and seeing how valuable that is, then let's make a conscious choice to follow that path and not simply let our mind be on automatic, grasping at whatever seems is going to give us a little bit of temporary pleasure. And yet preparing for a future life, while good, isn't the end all of the path. It's a stopgap measure to prevent the misery of the lower realms. But what we really want is to be free of all of cyclic existence. And that entails overcoming the wrong views, the incorrect innate graspings that we have. And that's done by generating wisdom, which is gained on the basis of concentration, which is attained on the basis of ethical conduct. And yet even our own liberation isn't sufficient, because we're always surrounded by the kindness of others, other living beings who are exactly like us, wanting happiness and not suffering, other living beings on whom we're completely dependent to stay alive. And so it's only right that the aspiration for liberation includes them, because we can't survive without sentient beings. So when we really care about them, then we want to attain Buddhahood, to be able to lead them on the path to liberation themselves. So let's generate that bodhicitta motivation. So sometimes a question may come in our mind. On one part of the path, we're saying other sentient beings can't come with us, that we have to separate from all of our friends and relatives. And so being attached to them is basically a burden. And being attached to them also serves as the impetus to create a great deal of negative karma in trying to please them and, you know, get them to like us and all that kind of thing. So on one hand we say that, and then on the other hand we say that sentient beings are so kind to us and we can't live without them, and we should, you know, really have this incredible, profound love and compassion for them. And so sometimes it may appear like, well, wait a minute, I don't get it. You know, first you're telling me just don't get so involved in sentient beings and detach from them. And then you're telling me to be really involved with them and really love them. So isn't that contradictory? Seems like, doesn't it? Yeah, it can really seem contradictory. You know, well, wait, am I supposed to gravitate towards them? Am I supposed to gravitate away from them? You know, and move away from them? Are they, you know, things that, are they people that are only going to lead me to create non-virtue? Or, you know, that's what you tell me one time, and the other time you tell me my enlightenment depends on them? So how am I supposed to relate to all these other sentient beings? Okay, so here we really have to, it's a very good question, and it's something that it really takes a great deal of thought in our practice to understand on an intellectual level, and even more thought to be able to practice. Okay, what we're getting at is when we exaggerate the good qualities of someone or something, and because we've exaggerated it, made it better than it is, then this clinging and craving arises in our mind. Yeah. Well, this sentient being is so wonderful. I always want to be near them. Being near them is going to make me happy forever, and they've been so kind, and, you know, I so much appreciate it. I feel such a heart connection with them, you know. So this kind of thing can, you know, just spill into attachment, because we're only feeling that way about some people, not about everybody. Okay, so there's some bias going on in there. And then also there's some exaggeration, because the mind is only seeing good in those particular people. They can't do anything wrong. Yeah, so the mind is somehow distorted, isn't it? Yeah, people you're attached to, they don't do anything wrong, do they? Yeah, a little bit, but not much. And even that, they didn't really mean it. Because they're so wonderful. Basically, because they make me happy. So you can see there's a lot of, you know, self-concern in there, and exaggeration and lopsided balance, and then a very sticky mind. You know, I'm going to be miserable if I can't be with them. So that's the area of attachment that creates the difficulties. On the other hand, when we see that sentient beings have been kind to us, we're not exaggerating some specific quality of an individual. We're seeing that all sentient beings have been kind to us. And we're not saying that sentient beings have only been kind to us, because we're also realizing that they're overwhelmed by afflictions. Yeah. So while they've been kind, they also are overwhelmed by afflictions. So when we see sentient beings like that, then we don't exaggerate their good qualities. We don't cling on to them thinking that they're going to make us forever happy, because we see that they're unable to. But at the same time, we see that they want happiness like we do, and that they've been kind to us. And they've also been kind to everybody else. So it's not just based on they've been kind to me, like it is when we have attachment for somebody. Okay? So we have to really learn to discriminate attachment from genuine love. And not only discriminate it on an intellectual level, but discriminate it in our own heart, and to know when we feel one and when we feel the other. Because we so easily, call attachment love. And as soon as we learn some Dharma jargon, we just kind of gloss over our attachment with Dharma jargon saying that it's love. Yeah? But if we really look carefully, we'll see that there's a lot of bias there. There's a lot of strings, there's a lot of self-centeredness. And if that person changed their behavior in any way, we certainly would change our feeling about them. Whereas when we have love, even if a sentient being doesn't act nice towards us, we still see that they have been kind, and we still see that they are overcome by afflictions. So our underlying feeling for them doesn't change, even though they mistreat us. Okay. So we can see that, because that's one of the qualities of a Buddha. Buddha treats everybody equally in terms of the Buddha's own feeling level. Yeah, even though one person may praise him and make offerings, and the other person may criticize and be obnoxious. Okay, so when we're really having a bodhisattva mind, our feeling of closeness to sentient beings is not going to quiver and shake depending upon how they treat us at any particular moment. So there needs to be a lot of strength in that mind to really have love and compassion. The mind has to be very strong, because as soon as we slip into self-concern, then our feeling of closeness and care for others slips as soon as their behavior changes. Right? Can you see that? So, this whole thing of really caring for the others has to, it goes beyond just how this person's being nice to me at this particular time. But we're suckers for people being nice to us, aren't we? We're suckers for people who give us presents and tell us we're wonderful and praise us. We'll just do anything to get that. And then we wonder why we have difficult relationships. It's all coming because of the choices we make from our own blindness. Okay. Whereas if we kind of increase the scope of our mind, and anybody we see, this is a sentient being who's been kind to me, but it was also overwhelmed by the three poisons. So there's nothing to get attached to, but there's every reason to work for their benefit and to appreciate their kindness. Okay? Just a little bit. Motivation. We had one question from last week before I get into the teachings for this week. Okay, so somebody said, how to work with the interplay of two factors, mindfulness and introspective awareness. I believe it's the case that mindfulness needs a high degree of relaxation to be most effective, but it seems that introspective awareness has a task that requires more firmness, although not that of a taskmaster. The question is how to regulate the relaxation of mindfulness and the firmness of introspective awareness to be most effective in the meditation. Okay? Now, lying behind this, I think there's an assumption that firmness is tightness. Okay? And firmness is not tightness. You know, when I lead you through the body relaxation before we meditate, how I have you relax all the different parts of the body and let go of the tension. And at the end, I always say, feel how your body is at ease, but also your posture is very firm. I always say that. Okay? So I always say that so that people can see physically, your body can be relaxed, but your meditation position can be firm. Relaxed doesn't mean, you know, jello, okay? And firm doesn't mean okay? So if our body can be without tension and yet very firm, our mind can also be without tension and yet very firm. So with mindfulness, yeah, when you think, you know, what's the job of mindfulness? It's to place our mind on an object that we're already familiar with in such a way that we're not going to get distracted. So mindfulness requires firmness. However, if the mind confuses firmness and tightness and goes to tightness, that mental tightness is going to make us lose the object because the mind's too, you know, too brittle. Okay. So you need a relaxed mind so that you don't go to the extreme of being tight and brittle. But you also need to be firm. Okay? So think a little bit about how being relaxed and being firm can go together. Okay? It's like a really good chocolate cake. Yeah, a really good chocolate cake is moist, but it also stands up straight. Doesn't it? Yeah, it isn't moist and just like, yeah, wouldn't be very good texture. And yet, to stand up straight, it doesn't have to be all dried out. Okay, so the same thing with our mind. Okay? Got it? Then another thing that somebody told me last week when I was talking about the importance of sitting up straight when we meditate, and I gave untangling yourself when you meditate. I gave the example of imagining that somebody was pulling you up, you know, here, so that your spine was straight. Yeah. Somebody else told me that. What he finds helpful is to say, elongate your waist. Okay? So kind of sit so that your waist is elongated. Yeah? And if you do that, then you're going to be sitting up straight. Okay? So we want to do that as much as possible. Because the thing is, when we start to slouch, then we very easily get drowsy. Mm-hmm. Don't we? Okay, so let's just review a little bit. Last week I started talking about the six meditations from the Abhidharma Kosha, the Treasury of Knowledge by Vasubandhu, and this is part of the preparatory practice for the four establishments of mindfulness. So we started out with counting the breath, okay, breathing, counting each cycle of out and in as one, and going up to 10, yeah, not going to higher so we don't get distracted, not going less so that we don't get too lax and lazy. Okay, so there you're just trying to be able to keep your mind on your breath, and you're using the counting as a way to do it. Okay. In the Theravada tradition, at least in Thailand, they often use the syllables Bu-do. I don't know why they don't say Buddha. That would make more sense. But they always put O's on the end of everything. So they use the syllables, you know, Bu for one part of the breath and Do for the other. Okay? But similarly, you know, one out and in can be one, another out and in two. So that's just to get you fixed on the breath, get your mindfulness on the breath. Then the second part is called following the breath. And here you follow the breath as it enters and you experience it going down through your throat and the heart and the center of your body to the soles of your feet and then coming up again. Okay? And when it goes out, when you exhale, it goes a little bit out. Okay? And, you know, you breathe in to the soles of your feet and out again. When your concentration is better, then when you exhale, you can imagine the air goes a little bit further away, you know, maybe a foot away or something. But don't do too far at the beginning because it'll bring confusion and distraction. Okay? So, yeah. So there, now you're getting more introspective and really following the feeling of the breath in your body, yeah, as it fills your body. Then the third one is called placing. And here you see your breath as it comes in and goes down through your body into the soles of your feet. You see it as a thread, you know, a very fine thread. And here, you're not focusing so much on you're not focusing at all on the inhalation and exhalation, but rather you're examining the internal sensations in the body along this thread. Okay? So what is the breath becomes this thread through your body. And you're seeing, you know, is it hot, is it cold, is it comfortable, or is it uncomfortable? Okay? And so here, you're going to a much more refined level of the breath because you're not paying attention to the gross inhalation and exhalation. You're paying attention to a much more subtle movement of the internal wind in the body. Okay? Because we have wind moving in our wind element moving in our body all the time. Then the fourth step is analyzing. And here, you're starting to inspect things closer. You're not just, you know, observing hot and cold or comfortable or uncomfortable or rough or coarse. But you're seeing that we talked last week about how the breath also has the other elements in it. You can have a heaviness to the breath, which is the earth element, a moistness, which is the water element, a warmth, which is the heat element, motility, which is, well, that's the air element. Okay? So you begin to be aware of how the breath, you know, although it's primarily the wind element, the other elements are also involved there. Okay? And then we're saying how you examine how the breath is not only the four principal elements, but also the derivatives. Okay? So, you know, you question, does your breath have color? Well, maybe, you know, if it's pretty smoky out, it has color. Does it have scent? If you've been painting the door in a closed room, yeah, your breath is going to have scent. Does it make noise? Does it have a taste? We know it has a tactile sensation. Okay, so you're analyzing the breath there in terms of the four elements and the four elemental derivatives. Okay, then another part on this part of analyzing, which is really interesting, is to observe how the mind and mental factors relates to the breath. Okay, we usually think of the breath as the body. My mind and my mental factors are the mind, never the twain shall meet. But in actual fact, when we sit and watch, we see there's a lot of correlation and relationship between our breathing and our mental states. Okay? When we're relaxed, what is our emotionally relaxed, what is our breathing pattern? It's slower, isn't it? When we're excited, what is our breathing pattern? Faster. That's why I find it interesting for people to say, I sit down and watch TV to relax. Because when you watch TV, you know, all the scenes actually make your mind excited. I doubt that when you watch TV, your breath becomes very slow and relaxed. I think, you know, when you're watching the movies and that, you know, there's war in the movies or there's sex or something like that, your body reacts. And it reacts, you know, getting more excited, more, you know, adrenaline going. So that's not relaxation. But very interesting to watch, you know, how our moods relate to our breath. And when you do that, then you can begin to see how sometimes just changing your breath a little bit can change your mood a bit. And this can also be very good, you know, when you're working with other people. Sometimes you're with people and watch what their breathing pattern is. Yeah? You can listen for it. You can watch, you know, the movement of their body. You can learn a lot about what they're really feeling when you see what their breathing pattern is. Because when somebody's really upset, their breathing pattern is disturbed, isn't it? Yeah. And so at that time, it can be very helpful if you're trying to help the person calm down to start out maybe matching their breathing pattern for a minute so that they feel understood. And then slowly start to slow down your breathing pattern and see if they slowly start to slow theirs down. And when their breathing pattern is slower, if they calm down, they usually do. Okay. Similarly, you know, if we find that we're getting excited or we're trembling or we're nervous or we're afraid, you know, watch the breath in the body and how your breathing pattern is. And don't force it to change, but just a little bit. Try and, you know, maybe slow it down or become more mindful of it. You know, you don't want to be doing deep breathing or anything. Yeah. But if you slow your breath, your mind's going to change. So this can be very interesting if you become really sensitive to this relationship of your breath and your mind, because a lot of times, you know, people are quite different. Some people don't understand what they're feeling emotionally, they will get a clue when they understand how their body feels. Okay? And so for some people, tuning into the feeling in their body will help them see how they feel emotionally. Yeah? Other people, they are much more in tune with how they feel emotionally, but they're completely out of touch with what's going on in their body. And some of us are out of touch with both our body and our mind. Yeah. So this is a very good exercise for helping us to get in touch with both our body and our mind, yeah, which is important for being able to take care of them just in an everyday way and keep them healthy. But it's also very important for, you know, regulating the mind so that we don't get overpowered by afflictions and create a lot of negative karma. Okay? So, very interesting. Try and work with that. Yeah. Watch the relationship of the breath and the mind. And watch, you know, how sometimes we sigh a lot. You know, we might go, and often, you know, the Tibetans consider when somebody does that that there might be some imbalance of the wind, or that sighing can cause an imbalance of the wind. You know, because in some ways it's quite unnatural, isn't it? I mean, we do that like when we're tired, aren't we? Or we're exhausted, when our mind isn't completely, you know, peaceful and calm. We just, yeah. And so in some way that can actually create that kind of mood in us if we tend to do that a lot. Okay? And so in the same way, you know, start to be sensitive to your body and, you know, watch when your body starts tensing up. Yeah, I went to the dentist yesterday and, you know, I'm not afraid of the dentist at all. My father was a dentist. I'm quite used to sitting in a dental chair and having people poke around in my mouth. But still, you know, on one hand, I'm used to that, but still, I was watching every so often, you know, I would just pay attention to my body, and there was some tension, and I would relax it. And then I'd check back, you know, a minute later, and there's tensions there again. How did it get there? You know, I thought I was paying attention. Well, I wasn't, so relax it again. Yeah. So, quite interesting, you know, all these, you can observe in all these different situations. And especially watch, you know, when you're impatient, like you're standing in line and you're in a hurry and you want everything to go quicker than it's going, yeah? Watch your mental state and watch your breath, okay? And see how your breath and your mental state both change while you're standing in line. And you can see that sometimes with the people in front of you in line. Yeah. And if you just watch, you can tell what people are internal state by watching their breathing patterns. Hmm. Okay, so this one of analyzing is becoming clued into that and aware of that. Okay. And you know, this awareness is very, very good. You know, it leads you into in tantric practice. You know, you get a lot into the winds and how the winds, the internal winds, and how they relate with perception and mental states and so on. Okay, then the fifth one is called transforming. And here, you're not on the breath anymore at all, not even on the fine line of the breath, not analyzing the breath at all, but rather the awareness that is familiar with concentrating on the breath is now transformed into the four stages of the path of preparation. In other words, the mind that has become more calmer and more focused and concentrated by meditating on the breath, you now conjoin with an understanding of emptiness, at least an intellectual understanding of emptiness, which leads you to the union of serenity and insight, also called the union of shamatha and vipassana. And at that point, that's the entrance into the path of preparation, which has four stages. Okay, it's, heat, peak, patience, and supreme dharma. Okay, and then, okay, so you're now starting to meditate on emptiness and starting to meditate on the Four Noble Truths. And then the sixth step in this meditation is called purifying. And here, that mind that was previously focused on the four progressive parts of the path of meditation is now meditating, is now transformed into the path of seeing and the path of meditation. Okay? So that that conceptual realization of emptiness is now becoming a direct perception of emptiness, still a union of serenity and insight. Okay? So this is taught in the Abhidharma Kosha. So it's a practice that the hearers, solitary realizers, and also the bodhisattvas engage in. And it can be very, very helpful. Clearly, they're progressive, you know, and the initial ones are much easier than the later ones. So you do them in that row and in that order. And then, as I explain, you can, you know, do a little bit of one and then go on to the next, you know, in one session or one day the other. But if you're really trying to gain realizations, then you want to really master one before you go on to the next. You know, you might still experiment with the next and try it out and get some familiarity, but you want to really gain some stability in the first one before you put all your attention on doing the second one. Okay? So those six are often taught to stop mental busyness and distraction and lots of discursive thinking. Okay, so that's part of the preliminary practice for doing the four establishments of mindfulness, because it's good to have a little bit of concentration before you start, you know, becoming aware of these four objects. Okay, so now we're going to continue on in the root text. So the root text says there are eight parts to this decisive final analysis of the establishment of mindfulness. So this is the outline for the basic text. We went through this before. So first we talk about the observed objects, or it's also translated as focal objects, in other words, what we are meditating on. Then the second, the manner of meditation, how we meditate on these focal objects. Three, the reasons for doing the meditation. Four, the nature of the four establishments. Five, the divisions, what kind there are. Six, the boundaries, where on the path we find them. Seven, the etymology of the term, the four establishments of mindfulness. And eight, demonstrating that the establishments of mindfulness of the Mahayana are superior. So here really establishing that this is a bodhisattva practice, so it has to be done with bodhicitta, and how doing this practice with bodhicitta transforms the entire practice. Okay? And I might remark here that just as doing the practice with bodhicitta transforms the whole practice, according to your view of emptiness, too, that is going to transform the entire practice. So we're going to move on to the first point now, which is the observed objects, or the focal objects. So there's four observed objects for the establishment of mindfulness. Okay, the text says the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. So got to remember those four first of all. Okay. Now we're going to talk about what does it mean when we say body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. So there's three types of body: the external body, the internal body, and the body that's both external and internal. Okay. So the external body is talking about, and here body, we have to remember that the word body in Tibetan is zuk. Zuk also means form. Okay, similarly the Sanskrit Pali word is rupa. Rupa can mean body, it can also mean form. Form as in matter, okay, or material. So sometimes we translate that word body sometimes as matter, or material, or physical substance, or something like that. So when we're talking about the external body, we could, maybe a better translation would be external form, external matter. Okay? So those are the things external to the body. You know, the table, the different things, the colors and shapes that are not our body, that are, you know, that we contact through our sense powers, the sounds that we hear, the colors and shapes we see, the smells that we smell, the tactile sensations, rough, smooth, hot, cold, things like that that are external to us. Okay, so that's the external body, or the external matter. The internal body, or internal matter, is referring to the very subtle substances that are the sense powers. So, you know, at the back of the eyeball, they didn't say, what do you call it, cones and rods, right? They didn't have call it cones and rods in Buddhist time, but they said that there was a very subtle substance at the back of the eyeball that was the actual eye sense power that enabled us to see colors and shapes. Okay, or they didn't have the name anvil and stirrup in our ears, but they said there was a very subtle substance in the ear that allowed, you know, us to hear sounds and so on. Okay, so the same thing, you know, with the tongue or with the nose. What do they call the sensors in the nose? We have taste buds. What do we call what's in our nose?
Nose buds.
Anyway, whatever we call, I'm sure somebody online will write in and tell us. You know, that very subtle sense power, or the, you know, the taste buds, not the whole tongue, but the taste buds.
Is it olfactory?
Yeah, it's olfactory, but olfactory just means pertaining to smell. So it's, you know, some kind of sensors of some sort. You know, tactile, probably the nerve endings in our body that enable us to feel things, or the things, the sensors in our stomach so that we know when we're hungry or thirsty. Yeah. Okay, so these kinds, those are the inner sense, the inner body. And then the body that is both inner and outer, or both internal and external, refers to the gross object, you know. So the eyeball, yeah, or the ear, or the nose, or the tongue, or the skin, okay? So, you know, that is external in the sense that, you know, it has color and shape and we can perceive it and everything. But it's internal in the sense that it's affiliated with our mind stream, and it contains the subtle sensors, the subtle sense powers. Okay, so there's those three kinds of body. Then there's the second focal object is feeling. So there's three kinds of feeling. And here, we're using the word feeling. It doesn't mean emotion. Yeah, in English, the word feeling is very vague, and we, you know, it can often mean emotion, or we say somebody's feelings got hurt. Yeah. So the word feeling in English has many, many different meanings. Here, we're specifically talking about pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings. Okay? Sometimes it's called happy, painful, and neither happy nor painful. Yeah. So there's many words. Sometimes pleasant, happy, pleasurable, painful, suffering, unpleasant, neutral, although the actual term is neither pleasant nor unpleasant, neither happy nor suffering. Okay? So this is referring just to those feelings, you know, kind of a pleasurable or happy feeling. It's not referring to attachment or anger or those kinds of things. Okay? Although they may have this feeling component to it, because when we have attachment, there's very often a pleasurable feeling, although sometimes there's quite a painful feeling too. When we're angry, there's usually a painful feeling. There's ignorance, usually a neutral feeling. Yeah, not always. Yeah, sometimes unpleasant. We're upset because we're ignorant or whatever. So, you know, we're just talking about those three: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And those three feelings run our lives. Yeah? Because whenever we experience some pleasant feeling, how do we react? I want more. I don't want it to go away, and I want more. And I want better. When we have an unpleasant feeling, there's a painful feeling, a suffering feeling. How do we react? I don't like it. Get rid of it. I'm mad. I just can't. I'm averse to this. When we have a neutral feeling, how do we react? Ignorance. Okay? So these feelings, you know, are very, very important. You know, when we study the 12 links of dependent arising, you know, the link of feeling is followed by the link of clinging. Because as soon as we feel something, we cling in some way to "I want more and better," "get it away," or "blah." Okay? And it's based on our reactions to these three feelings that we generate afflictions, and the afflictions lead to the creation of karma. Karma leads to rebirth and cyclic existence. So when we, you know, when we talk about cutting the 12 links, one place where we can cut it is between feelings and clinging. Okay, but we need to have a lot of mindfulness and a lot of introspective alertness to notice that, because as you go through your day, how you react to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings. Just watch. Yeah, and it seems like there's no gap between them. Doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Kind of, somebody says, "Why did you do that?" Yeah, there's an unpleasant feeling from the sound. Immediately, we're ticked off. You know, the anger follows so close that it feels like the other person made us angry. Yeah? Like, they gave it to us. We caught it from them. But actually, there's, you know, an unpleasant feeling, and we're reacting to that feeling. The same thing with pleasure. Yeah, we have a pleasurable feeling, and all, seamlessly, our mind goes into, I want more, and I don't want it to go away. Yeah. We don't analyze the feeling. We don't ask ourselves, is this going to bring me everlasting happiness? We don't say, how is this feeling making me act? Anything like that. We just immediately go from feeling into a, you know, pleasant feeling into attachment. Okay? Same thing with neutral feeling. Yeah? Fall asleep. Get lazy. Space out. Our favorite habit. Okay? So this kind of mindfulness of feeling is going to be a real important one. Okay? Then the third object, mind, here refers to the primary consciousnesses. So when we study the mind and mental factors, we often divide them into primary consciousnesses and mental factors. Okay? By primary consciousnesses, we are referring to the consciousness that corresponds with the sense organ that enables us to contact a certain kind of object. So there's the visual consciousness that is stimulated when the eye organ meets with color and shape. There's the auditory consciousness that arises when the ear organ, the ear, not the organ, the ear of sense power, you know, contacts with sound. There's the olfactory consciousness that arises when whatever they're called in our nose comes in contact with smells. And similarly, there's the gustatory consciousness that arises when the taste sense power contacts taste, the tactile consciousness that arises when the sensors in the skin or the stomach contact their objects, external things, and the mental consciousness that arises often when we're thinking. There's conceptual mental consciousness, and then there's non-conceptual mental consciousness, such as yogic direct perception or clairvoyance or the direct perception of emptiness, the direct perception of impermanence, things like that. But a lot of the time our mental consciousness is thinking, it's conceptual mental consciousness. So according to the feel, the object, and the sense organ, then we have those consciousnesses. The sense the powers, I keep saying sense organ, I mean sense power. The sense power for the mental consciousness can be any of the other consciousnesses. Yeah. After we smell something, we think about it. After we see something, we think about it. After we hear something, we think about it. Okay? So all those other consciousnesses can be actually the power that make the mental consciousness arise. Okay? So when we're talking about mind, we're just talking about those primary consciousnesses. When we go on to the fourth object, phenomena, there that includes the mental factors. Okay? So mental factors, actually feeling is a mental factor, but it's its own object. Okay, we have 52 mental factors according to the Compendium of Knowledge. We actually have 84,000 mental factors. Yeah, except we all feel that we're special and we either have one more or one less. You know? But, you know, we all have 84,000. So, you know, those are different mental factors. And the mental factors, they fill out the consciousness, you know. Mindfulness is a mental factor. Attention, contact with the object, wisdom, okay, ignorance, anger, attachment, confidence, Yeah, responsiveness, the balanced mind of non-attachment, compassion, love. These are all mental factors. Okay, so they enable us to affect how we relate to the object that the primary consciousness is apprehending. Okay? So the mental factors are part of what we include in phenomena. Yeah? But phenomena also, in the Pali tradition, they list specifically in it the five hindrances. So these are the five hindrances to serenity. Yeah? Sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, dullness and drowsiness, regret and restlessness, and doubt. Okay? So they talk about those. The five aggregates are also included under phenomena. So, the body or form, feeling, discrimination, conditioning factors, and consciousness. Yeah. The 12 sense sources or ayatanas, so these include the 6 objects and then the 6 sense powers. The 7 enlightenment factors, so that's one group of 7 that makes up those 7 are 7 of the 37 harmonies to enlightenment. So they're mindfulness, discrimination of phenomena, effort, what else? Rapture, responsiveness, concentration, and equanimity. Okay, those are the 7 enlightenment factors. Other ones are the 4 Noble Truths. Yeah, contemplation of the 4 Noble Truths falls within the establishment of mindfulness on phenomena. Okay. And so here there follows a quote from the Compendium of Knowledge, which states, "What are the objects of observation, or the focal objects, of the establishments of mindfulness? The body, feelings, mind, and phenomena." And so we just talked about what those are in more depth. Okay. So we have a couple of minutes for questions, if you have any. Yeah.
It's a technical question. Mm-hmm. When I was doing the first breathing meditation, the sound, the counting in my mind was getting in the way of everything else. It was like one. Or just being more concerned with the number than.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so when you were doing the breathing meditation, you were getting hung up in the numbers and just, the fact of saying them and like that. Yeah, sometimes that can be an interference. If it's an interference, then, try and just be aware of exhalation and inhalation. Okay.
Mm-hmm. You said that for those preliminaries, we should progressively master them in order, and but they're taught also to stabilize the scarce thought and increase concentration. Mm-hmm. So, are there substitutes you can do for the earlier ones that just to increase the concentration before you get to the ones where you really contemplate emptiness and the Four Noble Truths?
Well, those are the first ones that you're doing that help you, the counting and the placing. Those are the ones that you do. I don't think I'm understanding your question.
Yeah, so are there different types of meditations besides that we could replace or do instead of counting the breath and doing the
breath? Oh, okay. Okay, so instead of counting the breath, are there other meditations you can do to just calm the mind down before you start a meditation? Yeah. Usually they recommend watching the breath as a way of calming the mind down before we start meditation. That doesn't mean that you have to watch the breath for a long time, but they, You know, that's what they usually recommend. You know, if you sit down to meditate and your mind's turbulent or whatever, to sit and just focus, you know, a few minutes on the breath. But they never talk about people, what to do if you have allergies and stuffed nose and, you know, because some of us have difficulty breathing, you know. And so I remember one time I was teaching a retreat, teaching the breathing meditation, and my sinuses were just going completely berserk, and, you know, both nostrils were stuffed. There was no way I could, you know, watch my breath. So in that case, you know, you're not going to be able to watch your breath here. Maybe, but it is difficult. I mean, when you're completely stuffed up, to watch your breath can sometimes, some people have told me that it makes them actually more anxious. Yeah. You know, because they're breathing through their mouth and they have asthma and they can't breathe smoothly, so it makes them more anxious. If that were happening, then I would say, like, use the figure of the Buddha. Usually the figure of the Buddha is said to be one of the objects that you generate serenity on, and we'll talk about that this weekend. But if the breath is not working to calm your mind, then use the figure of the Buddha and focus on that to calm your mind.
Two things. One is, it seemed like when you did the counting that you didn't really focus on physical sensations.
Mm.
That was kind of odd.
Okay.
I tried it a number of times.
Yeah, so it seems like when you're doing the counting, you're not focusing on physical sensations. Then you're emphasizing too much the counting.
Mm-hmm.
That may have been your problem too. The counting is just an aid to help you stay focused.
Mm-hmm.
The counting is not the object of meditation.
But then the way it was described, what is the object? The breath going through the hole?
No, the inhalation, the exhalation. Mm-hmm. Watching, I'm about to breathe in, I am breathing in. The breath, the in-breath is about to finish, it has finished. I'm about to start exhaling, I am exhaling, the exhalation is almost finished, it has finished. That's what you're focusing on, that's your object of meditation. The counting is just designed to help you observe your breath in that kind of detail and not space out. But the numbers are not what you should be focusing on. Okay, so if the numbers are distracting to you, that's because you need to focus on the breath. And so, if you want to drop the numbers, go ahead. But you need to be more aware of the different phases of the breath. Okay?
Yeah, I think what I'm intuiting is that before I always paid attention to even the stomach and the nose, but I feel like I need to pay attention to the air.
Well, you said that you usually pay attention to the stomach or the nose. You're paying attention to the sensation of the air as it passes through here, or the sensation of your belly as it rises and falls. That is very intimately linked with the air, because you're not this. What's the sensation you're feeling at your nose? It's the air going by. Okay, why are you feeling your belly expand? Because the air is going in. So it's not like you're differentiating these things out.
I guess I had the impression from last week that we weren't to pay attention to those physical sensations. You kind of have that wrong.
Yeah.
And then what's the measure of having accomplished one?
That you know, you can get up to 10 and your mind isn't all over the place, and you're able to really focus on, you know, these different phases of the breath for a period of time.
Mm-hmm. It seems like almost like half of my mind is focusing on the breath, and the other half, maybe a little bit more loosely, it's focusing on other things,
mm-hmm.
thinking about things, but I'm also questioning what is the breath.
Yeah.
So what do you recommend for that?
Okay, so the time, we're kind of on the breath, part of our mind's on the breath, part of our mind's roaming the universe. Okay?
Fully lost the breath.
Yeah.
It's not fully present with the
breath. Right. Actually, your mind is going back and forth, kind of on the breath, kind of away from the breath. Very, it's going back and forth quite quickly. So what you need to really do is anchor your mindfulness and your attention to the breath, you know, and cut out all that discursive stuff.
Also a question about sort of what the end should be, because when I'm working on my breath, I'm quite aware of the relaxation that comes with my body.
Mm-hmm.
But when I use the Buddha, which I do sometimes, the mm-hmm. quality of my mind is so much brighter.
Mm-hmm.
That both times then I will go on and do the rest of my practices after doing some of that concentration. And so the quality of the mind that comes from focusing on the Buddha is so much clearer and brighter. I'm wondering if that should be what I'm hoping to achieve by also have focusing on the breath.
Yeah. You know, a number of people have said that. You know, and I'll talk about that this weekend. One of my friends just did a retreat on developing the serenity. And she said that usually she would focus on the breath. She didn't like at all focusing on the Buddha, but since the instructions were to focus on the Buddha, she decided to try that. And she said she was amazed at how much clearer her mind was focusing on the Buddha, and that she was able to see immediately when she got distracted. Whereas with the breath, she couldn't always tell immediately when she was distracted. Yeah. So that could be one of the reasons why the Buddha is recommended as an object. Yeah. But of course everybody's different and it's not going to work for everybody.
So it's not, I don't need to do that as the goal. Like this is the measure of having gotten somewhere with breathing meditation, is if my mind feels as clear on the breath as it feels on the Buddha, then, or is that just irrelevant? Irrelevant. Okay.
Yeah. You use whatever meditation works. Okay? Okay. Good. So I think, you know, try and observe what are the three feelings this next week, you know, and try and observe what's the primary consciousness, what's the mental factors. Observe the three types of body or three types of form. Okay? So try and just discern those and in your meditation and out of your meditation as well.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life, may I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances, grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Guru Ratnamandala Kamiryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious woody mind not yet born arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin gets of generosity. May you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the ten directions, and especially at your Vastia being the West. Guru.